I was talking with actually some students that I'm coaching in for a cooking competition about a week from now.
Uh-huh.
And they were really keen to do this. I don't know if there's a better word for it, but this splatter plating where you you have a puree and you either fling it, like put it on a spoon and then fling it onto the plate so that it splatters, like a Jackson Pollock kind of effect. Or you can kind of spoon the puree onto the plate and then tap it with the back of the spoon so you get the same kind of effect.
It's like, yeah, totally.
So like little bits are flung all over the plate. And yeah, you see it a lot on Instagram and feeds like that. What do you think of that, Shale?
Well, I mean, there's definitely a time and a place when it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that we're talking about it as I don't know, like a concept that we both have seen and understand as sort of like a pervasive aesthetic for how to plate a certain type of like modern food.
Mm-hmm.
It's already broken. The fact that we can just talk about it and call it splatter plating, it's already outside of its like intended purpose, I feel like. And it's already made it too far into like actual popular aesthetics.
Do you mean that it shouldn't be used frequently, or what do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, it makes sense to use it. Like, okay, so I think probably one of the most famous examples of splatter plating is the, what's it called?
Oops, I dropped the lemon tart.
Yeah, oops, I dropped the lemon tart, right?
If you're playing the food court drinking game, you now have to finish your drink because we mentioned oops, I dropped the lemon tart again.
Yeah, so in the case of oops, I dropped the lemon tart, it's a whimsical part of the dish, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's a reason why that plating exists in that dish conceptually,
mm-hmm.
and that's that you drop the food on the plate by accident or something. And I'm not saying that that's the only possible context in which it makes sense or has some kind of purpose. Like, I don't think that it has to be necessarily as conceptually tied to mm-hmm. the, you know, like the, I guess, logistical conceit of the dish as that. Like, I don't begrudge anyone using it as a legitimately like creative part of plating a dish.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that like if you see somebody else do it and you think that it looks cool and you're envious that you didn't come up with an idea to do something that way, and so you're just going to copy it because you think that it will make your dish stand out, that's not really a good enough reason for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if there's like, I don't know, the only examples that I can think of are gross. Like for some reason I think of like blood splatter when I think of this, of like splatter plating or something.
Okay.
Like if you did that with a red sauce, it would definitely look like a crime scene. And so,
absolutely.
You know, and so maybe you want to make your diner feel uncomfortable. And I'm not saying that that's not a legitimate thing that you can present during like a modern eating experience and have it have a, you know, like an effect on your diner, the effect that you want to have on your diner.
Mm-hmm.
But like, yeah, if it's strictly an aesthetic choice because you want your plate to look like a Jackson Pollock or something like that, I don't know. It seems...
And that's actually another Osteria Francescana dish, right? Is a beef tenderloin Jackson Pollock. And so, like, the sauces are splattered in that manner.
I mean, that's interesting. It would be more interesting if Jackson Pollock was the one who was doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
and this is kind of a petty thing to say. I've eaten that dish and it wasn't great. it looked cool, but like the beef was... Yeah. Whatever, it was sous vide beef tenderloin rolled in leek ash. Like, it was fine.
Man, Alan, that's so sad.
Anyways, that's another, could be in a whole other episode, my dinner at Osteria Francescana. But
yeah, how come that's not on our topics list?
Just like a run, like maybe like a detailed description of some Michelin starred experiences, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I think we could just strictly talk about your meal and then,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm sure it would spin off into other sort of, Yeah.
Yeah. I've got pretty good
fine dining meal topics.
It was like an era where I was carrying my moleskin notebook around and drawing plate diagrams of everything that I ate and stuff. So yeah. Anyways, yeah, we've got the info, the documentation. But okay, so the splatter technique. Personally, I think it looks awesome. Like when I see it, I'm like, wow, it's so dynamic and it's like natural.
Yeah, it can, for sure. Yeah.
But if you've ever been in a kitchen where you have to actually, it's one thing to do that at home in your own kitchen, on your counter, do it and then take a picture of it. But on a line during service, it's a disaster. It's so messy. It gets everywhere.
Yeah. That definitely occurred to me. But I also, what occurred to me also, though, is that if you had a dish like that on your menu, you could set up your kitchen in a way so that you could do it in a, I mean, you could set up an area in your kitchen where you could do it cleanly.
Yes. So there's some examples of it, like in the patisserie lab at Nate, they do this effect on one of the preparations, and they have a special little box that they put the dish in,
right,
and then do the splatter or whatever, the flinging, and then it's all contained in the box, and that's fine, say like in the context of an a la carte service. But in this situation that I was discussing this week, it's it's a banquet style competition, and so we have to do say 25 plates. We have to make 25 apps, mains, and dessert each. So picture laying out 25 plates for the entree and then splattering all of them. It's a
The first thing that occurs to me is like a plastic sheet.
Okay.
You just like, when you go to plate that dish, put a...
let me finish.
All right.
Okay. So it's a red... There's a red beet puree and a gold beet puree. Splatter, splatter, splatter. Stuff goes everywhere, even if you have some kind of control, like whatever, it's going to get on your chef whites. It's going to make a mess. The little tiny droplets, you can't control really precisely where they go. And so some of them end up really close to the rim of the plate. And that's problematic for the servers who are running it.
Right.
And in the context of a competition where you're being assessed on your cleanliness, organization, speed, ease of service, it just seems like such a bad idea.
Yeah.
And that was my argument to the students. They were not.
I mean, I have to agree. It's a bad choice to make.
Yeah.
At the same time, I mean,
it's a bold choice.
Provided that my needs are met, in that, like, it actually makes sense for the dish and it's not just an aesthetic choice because you're jealous that somebody else got to do it. Mm. If it actually has some meaning in the dish and is going to make the dish look great, and you can figure out a way to pull it off without making everything seem disorganized and, you know. But all of those things are... I highly doubt that all of those points are met, you know.
Yeah.
And in which case, it's just a bad choice. It's just like setting yourself up to fail.
Like the risk-reward is not in your favor. Like it, because even if you do it... find a way to do it very cleanly, nothing on the rim, whatever. Like, you can still make, like, the points that you get for presentation are not gonna, like, you can get those points at a much simpler way without having to worry about the...
Yeah.
Anyway, and the other thing, like, when the really tiny droplets happen on the plate and you're working under heat lamps, they just dry and cake on almost instantly and still looks fine. But then you go to eat it and it's like, oh, this is like...
just like horrible, pasty... goop that's like stuck to the plate.
To me, I think obviously there's a way to do it, but it's one of those things that is kind of like great on Instagram, problematic
not so
in a
great
restaurant
in
environment. But
I mean, I agree, and if like there are contexts in which I'm sure that it's worth it to do the, you know, fix all of the problems that it has, like logistically, but I can't really, unless your idea is just so like so meaningless without that plating, it just seems like a very, I don't know, daunting choice to make or something. And if you're just doing it out of like artistic egotism, then I'm probably not into your food anyway. I don't know. Actually, sounds harsh, but like,
can I float an idea for a dish that would use the effect really well?
Yeah.
I think in the food as medicine, I can't remember what we named the conversation, but the the cooking kind of seminar or whatever, the cooking camp thing that I did in the bush with Kevin Costwin, that was called Food as Medicine.
Yeah.
We did with the elk entree, there was like really aggressively charred carrots that were cooked over fire and then like cut in half. So you had the basically black exterior and then the really bright orange interior. Mm-hmm. So what if you had a dish that was just like, just call it fire roasted carrots.
Okay.
And you have those charred carrots. So you have the black and the orange, but then you have orange carrots and gold carrots mm-hmm. and you make a puree out of each and you do splatter orange, splatter yellow. And then at the base of the splatter, there's like the black carrots and it kind of like evokes this image of a campfire where you have orange and gold splatter and then black, like the roasted veg on it.
Right. Like splatter is the fire.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is that corny? I mean, you could have leek ash on the bottom.
You could have carrot ash.
Yeah. Alan. Yeah. 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 Carrot top ash, or I don't know if that would taste like anything.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Is that dumb? Yeah. That's not my, I don't usually.
I mean, no, it's not. I don't think it's dumb necessarily, but I do think that, like, I don't know. There's, I shouldn't be putting so much serious thought into this, I feel like, but I do feel like the splatter aesthetic evokes more water than fire.
Oh my
God. Even though the color, you know, like even though the color is like red and yellow or red and orange, like that mm-hmm. obviously is going to evoke fire. I'd want to see it to see yeah. if it actually like evoked fire or whether there would be a better way to do that.
Right.
Like maybe instead of the splatter, maybe like a few drags that look like, you mm-hmm. know, kind of curling flames.
Get the pastry brush out. We're going to paint a fire onto a plate.
Yeah. Why not just put a campfire in the middle of the plate, Alan?
That reminds me of like, there was a documentary about about Fran Adria. Okay. About a season at El Bulli. And the theme of the season was water. And he was really excited by this idea. Like they were finding different ways to like, you know, serve like ice preparations. And it was like, what, you know, because people will say, what did they serve at El Bulli this year? And he'd be like, water. They just served water. And so maybe you could just serve fire. Somehow.
Yeah, exactly. That's perfect. Your customers could come in and get warm and then go to a different restaurant.
Exactly. Eat a flaming marshmallow and then sue you into the Stone Age. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sutterby, and I'm here with my good buddy, Shale McDonald. How are you, Shale?
Great, Alan.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
Yeah, we do. What are we going to talk about today, Alan? Normally, I say tonight, because we normally record at night, but mm-hmm. last few times we've been recording during the day. It's kind of nice. I feel like,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's just that I'm more caffeinated, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel much more focused.
but I feel like I'm just like more ready to talk.
Mm-hmm. Me too. I feel like you're going to kind of drive the bus on this one.
Yeah, well, before we get into it, do we have any follow-up?
I think there were items that...
I seem to remember something specifically last episode where you seemed unsure of something and then I was like, oh, by next episode you're gonna have that figured out for sure, but I don't remember what it was off the top of my head.
I remember that vaguely too, and I remember it, but you were kind of making a joke because it was so trivial, but it was the kind of thing I would follow up about. But then I had a busy weekend. I don't even think I listened to the last recording, to be honest, so I don't know.
Holy smokes.
Harsh.
Well, it's okay, you listened to it while we recorded it, so.
Oh yeah, that's true. But no, I
you're listener number one, or like, I guess maybe, I don't know. We're both listener number one.
Listener 0.5.
Listener zero. Oh yeah, we're listener zero.
So no, I don't have anything.
Okay, great. Well, then we have topic, which, yeah, you're right. I'll kind of drive the bus and we'll see how it goes. It might be short and sweet, but I wanted to talk about, and I think that we've kind of like touched on this briefly before, like on the, you know, like as a sort of peripheral topic to other conversations that we've had, and it's not dissimilar to some other conversations that we had, but I kind of wanted to do do it in a little bit more organized way, and talk about recipe testing. So basically, like the process that you go through from having an idea in your head to having a dish that's executable, like on a restaurant menu or in a food service operation.
Yes.
And yeah, like I said, I think we've sort of like talked about what that's like before, but maybe not gone through the whole process, and maybe not in a way that's sort of like, I don't want to just say organized, but like also sort of, what's the word? You can do it, Shale.
How to do it in an intentional, thoughtful
systemized
way. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Systematic way. Yep. Yep. Totally. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How to do it in a systematic way. And so I've kind of like broken it down into sections. How I think probably in most cases, and definitely in my case, and you can let me know if this is similar to how it works in your head and when you're going through and trying to test a recipe. But it's so like, obviously it's going to start with an idea. So conceptualizing the dish, like what is it? What's your idea? And then usually right after that, some thoughts start going through my head and I start to consider what the feasibility issues might be. Okay. So we've got concept and then feasibility and then iteration. And then to me, this is like taking the idea and then taking in the feasibility, the potential feasibility issues, which might be things like, I don't know, cost, the equipment that you have to execute it, the time that you have to execute it in, those types of things, those sort of like logistical concerns, I guess, like probably procuring the product, things like that might be on the list of things that you would consider when you're considering whether it's possible to do the dish.
Right.
And then after that, you sort of decide what like variations you might want to test. So that to me is like iteration. You think about, okay, well, I've got this idea. So a lot of my most recent experience, obviously, is in creating like ice cream flavors.
Yes.
And so an example of iteration might be like, okay, I'm going to make, let's just say, maple bourbon pecan ice cream. Well, hey, there's a few ways that you could do that. Yeah. So the way that we wound up doing it at Kind Ice Cream is like the base, the ice cream base, the custard is flavored with like maple syrup and bourbon. And then we have maple candied pecans as like a solid inclusion. But there's a few different ways that you could do that. You could flavor the base like pecans and put maple candied pecans in it. Or you could, instead of flavoring the base like maple syrup, you could have plain base and then put a swirl of maple syrup in it. So how many of those like different sorts of iterations make sense, and how many of them do you want to test? How many of them seem like they might legitimately be good ideas? And then you have to take all those iterations and evaluate them. And so you do a tasting. And then generally, like for me, in that tasting section, you want to sort of like get as many people's opinions as possible.
Yes.
And you also want to have sort of like a system for the types of feedback that you want when people taste it. Like you want to gather as much feedback as possible. So you want to sort of have a list of like questions to ask the taster, or like different things that you want the taster to try and consider while they're tasting it and try and get feedback on all those things and try to write it down so that you can remember it later. Because often when you sit down with a group of people and start tasting things, the ideas fly fast and furious and it's like, you know, difficult to remember everything by the time you're done. And especially if you're tasting yourself, then you have your own set of ideas and you're weighing it against everybody else's feedback. And then basically like gathering that information, going back and testing it again with all that feedback in mind. And then obviously there's like the process of actually executing it. Once you've sort of decided what you want to do, then you have to figure out how to like properly execute it in the setting that you need to do it in or whatever. So if it's like, you know, if it's a dish on a dinner menu, you need to figure out how best to cook it on the line. And then once you're cooking it on the line, obviously you're going to continue to like refine the process of how you execute it to make sure that you're getting the details right every time, or that it's very repeatable, and that you know, the quality of the, and improve the quality of the dish hopefully over time, and the and like the time that it takes to execute and all of that stuff. You want to try and over time get better control over the dish, and over time you might also realize that there is something that you can do to improve the dish.
Right.
So yeah, it's sort of, I guess that makes it what?
At the highest level,
six steps.
Are the steps concept, first iteration, evaluation, reflection, feedback kind of situation?
Yeah, I think like, yeah, I guess, what was your first one? Concept?
Yes.
Yeah, I would definitely stick feasibility in there before iteration. But yeah.
So feasibility.
At the highest level, it's like concept, feasibility, iteration, analysis, tasting and analysis, and then execution, basically.
Sorry, I'm taking notes. Hold on, so that we're on the same page. Concept, feasibility, iteration.
Alan, you can just go back and listen to the podcast.
No, but I want to interact. I want to make sure that we get into each other.
I know, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, to me, yeah, it actually, so concept is the kind of like kernel at the center, and it can be, it's like, I want to work with this ingredient, or I want to work with this set of flavors, or it could be based on something else, right? Like it could be a plating conceit. Like it could be like, oh, I really want to make really good use of splatter plating. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And think about, so it can be anything, right? But it's like, it's basically the inspiration. Yeah.
Yeah. But then I think it's more than that. Like it like the inspiration part of it is part of the concept phase. But then also in the concept phase is like deciding how you want to, like figuring out the whole idea.
Yeah.
Basically, you know,
what's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Like, so I think anybody who like has tried to do creative cooking is familiar with like, concept phase, having an inspiration, a kernel, a jumping off point, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What's really interesting about this step is that for me to make something and be really excited about it and feel really proud of it at the end, there needs to be that through line of the concept all the way through all of these stages so that it comes out in the end. Because sometimes I start with a concept, and then once I think about feasibility and get feedback and understand what's possible, it becomes something completely different. And for me, it's usually like a composed, for the last couple of years, it's been like a composed plate is the end result.
Yeah.
And there's stuff that ends up being like, we work with what we have, the equipment, the ingredients, whatever. And in the end, we end up with something that's servable, acceptable. But if that initial inspiration isn't well displayed in the final plate, then I'm a little bit disappointed. And I'm like, well, I'm going
to
revisit.
It's like
I'm gonna
not
revisit
as gratifying.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think that like, so, and everybody works in a bit of a different way. And I feel exactly the same way that you do. Like if I have an inspiration for a dish, and then by the time we get to the end of the process of serving it to people, it doesn't really reflect the initial inspiration that I had, then yeah, it is disappointing. But I think that more often than not, like at least the way I approach this process, more often than not, I wind up with something that still has Like, I'm very rarely able to allow myself to fully give up on the initial inspiration for something. Right. Yeah. I mean, sometimes a dish just isn't going to work, and you try it, but mostly in those cases, I feel like the idea gets thrown out altogether rather than just sort of like getting made into something else. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe you stumble across something else that inspires you along the way, and then that is a different dish. But I feel like when that happens, that means that you're back in the concept phase, right? Like if you move out of the concept phase and you've figured out feasibly how you could potentially go about getting the ingredients and testing it, and you start testing it, and then you realize that it's not as exciting as you thought it was going to be or whatever, but another part of the dish is. Mm-hmm. And you want to work on that, well, then to me, that puts you back in the concept phase.
Right, yeah. Right. It's, but the concept portion of the process, that's the honeymoon. Do you know?
That's the courtship, Alan, the courtship.
But
the honeymoon
is the tasting,
I think, or something. The honeymoon is like seeing the delight on customers' faces, right?
No, I don't think so. I think that what you're calling the concept phase, because it includes issues around feasibility, it's a little bit more nuanced. But I guess
I don't think it does. I think those are two separate phases.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
You don't want to limit your conceptualization with your feasibility analysis. You want to be able to brainstorm any idea that you can possibly come up with. You don't want to like limit yourself to only coming up with feasible concepts.
So what I mean in the concept phase, because it's all in your head and it's like a kernel, a principle that you're excited about and want to work with. That's a honeymoon because it's early and you haven't realized how difficult it's going to be.
Yeah, no, that's true.
To make it happen. So that's what I mean.
Yeah, analogy holds for sure.
Yeah, so you get really excited and then you start thinking about feasibility. And it's like, oh yeah, but I don't have this or I need to make it on this timeline. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, or yeah, exactly. The idea needs to be finished by a specific time. Like I imagine that you run into that a lot. Like your timeline for testing an entire menu and being able to roll it out with a new group of students is probably feels very compressed.
Yeah, and the students in the class, like they develop special menus as a project. Right. And so for them, it's like, yeah, you've got 2 weeks or whatever and you're serving it on this date. And so, yeah, it's very, they go through it even on a more compressed timeline. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So for concept, like you said, it can be anything. It could be like a plating style. It could be an ingredient that you want to work with. Mm-hmm. It could be, I don't know, in the cases of like some of the, like where some modern chefs get their inspiration, it could be a walk in the forest or a diving trip that you had, or I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Can be.
And so like the things that are in the concept phase, I think are the brainstorming part and, you know, finding that inspiration, coming up with that inspiration, whether you're doing that intentionally or it just happens by accident in the shower or whatever. And then potentially also like some research. So to help flesh out the idea a little bit, what I usually do is I have an idea, then I usually wind up hitting the internet. Like, is this already an idea that's out there? Mm-hmm. You know, is this similar to something that I'm not aware of already? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is there, you know, is my sort of like first idea for how to execute this? Like, is there already a technique that somebody's using that I can, use to like execute this in a way that I think will be exciting or something like that. And then after I do a bunch of research and get really excited, then I start thinking about feasibility, or I try to limit myself to thinking about feasibility after I've kind of brainstormed some ideas.
Right. The feasibility point is we've talked about this a few times. I think the feasibility of an idea relies heavily or is informed heavily by the context of your operation or your situation.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's one thing.
Yeah, like you said, like if it's something that you just want to do at home and take a picture for Instagram, yeah. you might have a whole different set of like feasibility concerns versus executing it in a busy dinner service on a line or executing it, you know, like executing one plate or five plates might be very different than trying to execute like enough for 1,000 people to eat a day or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, in the case of ice cream, for me, in a lot of cases, the feasibility concerns are cost, availability of ingredients, and then also like, is it possible for us to make enough of this on a short enough timeline that we can have enough to make the number of batches that we would likely need to make in a day to meet customer demand?
Right.
And then there are some other ones, like there's equipment concerns, like do we have the equipment that we would need to execute this? So like recently we had, we featured a vegan flavor that was like a caramel apple. We did that in October for, because it's a spooky dessert, Alan. it was the first time that we'd really had apples in any of our ice cream. And so we needed a way to like quickly process apples. And so we had to get a couple of those like apple peeler corer things, those manual apple peeler corers that you can get at like Lee Valley or whatever. And and most of the people in the kitchen had never seen or used one of those before. So we had to kind of like train people on how to use them. And and so there's like, you know, all of these little things that you sort of, I mean, I feel like you should be thinking about these things up front. I'm sure that in a lot of cases, and also like once you get to like feasibility is sort of like, what can I predict about the feasibility of this? But then there's always going to be something down the road that you haven't thought of or quite, you know, quite often there's going to be something down the road that you haven't thought of that like a problem that you'll have to solve later on. And that's fine. But it's just sort of like feasibility to me is just like, consider like, is this going to be potentially cost effective? Like, you know, I don't think that it would ever be cost effective for us to have Ocetra caviar in an ice cream, you know? And so if that was somebody's idea, I feel like by the time we got to the feasibility phase and started thinking about cost, it would be like, well, I don't think that there's really a way to make this work.
No, the price structure for the caviar ice cream is you make a potato ice cream and sell it at a reasonable price, but then you can add caviar
add a
as
dollop
a topping
of caviar
for
as,
$50,
like for $100 or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that could work for sure.
The kinds of thing, like some of the other points in the feasibility stage, like you have to think about the skill set required to execute it and who will be executing it on the daily. And potential issues is a big one. So like whether it's cooking something or even like, so right, my daughter Cora has a spelling test every week. And so when we get the list of words for the next week, we go through them and we circle what we think will be tricky bits. So it's like, because it's like, you know, certain sets of vowels or it's like whatever, something that's not phonetic, not easy to sound out in your head. So those are like the potential issues. Those are the tricky bits and you have to circle them and then think about how you're going to
remember them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry to talk about not food. Sorry.
No, it's good. Yeah. Problem solving skills. Mm-hmm. They're important. And I think like, you know, when I'm going through this process, there are definitely like times when certain parts of it bleed into other parts, right? Like, you know, something like the caviar ice cream, the cost, as soon as the idea is in your head, the cost is in your head.
Right.
Like there's no separation between the idea of having caviar in a dish and the cost of it, you know, like that happens immediately. But you know, like, I think the idea is that while you're brainstorming, you don't necessarily want to let the feasibility concerns like deter you from having a concept,
right?
Which is what allows us to have the idea of having a potato ice cream and then charging for caviar to put it on top of it. You know, once you, and then like, having a phase of thinking about the potential sort of like issues that you might run into allows you to kind of like in a structured way decide which how many like different ways you might want to test it. So yeah, like probably we would never test the ice cream with caviar in it. We would only wind up testing the potato ice cream because we would know that it wouldn't be feasible to serve ice cream with caviar in it, right? And so then one idea that we might want to move forward with testing is, yeah, the potato ice cream with the caviar on top. And then maybe there's like another idea that like also could, like maybe also a buckwheat flavored ice cream with like pieces of blini in it or something like that might, or a sour cream ice cream, you know, might work with pieces of blini in it. And then you would put the caviar on top or something like that. So you might want to test both. You might want to test a potato ice cream and you might want to test a buckwheat ice cream with blini parts in it. And you might want to test a sour cream ice cream with blini parts in it. And then
totally. And that's kind of, so to me, like to get technical, to me, iteration is what happened. Like iteration is doing something again and again over time. And so that first, it's almost more like prototype. Like you, the first time you do it is like the first iteration, if you want to call it that, is like prototypes. And it is really important in a lot of the stuff we do to like, yeah, try it a few different ways. And a really simple example, like even for the that team that I'm coaching that I mentioned, we have braised fennel on a dish. And so in our prototype phase, we're like, okay, well, like we've got fennel. Let's cut it a couple different ways. Like it could be wedges. It could be petals. Let's cook it a couple different ways. And often in my context, that's often like comparing a classical or traditional technique with a modern one. And so for instance, we cut fennel into wedges and braise them kind of traditionally, like put them in a hot pan with oil, add aromatics, add Pernod and white wine and braise it. Or do we, let's vacuum pack some with butter and Pernod and steam it in the rationale. And like, is there any appreciable difference? So these kind of like A/B tests kind of where you just do them side by side and see what comes out. And then once you see which of those prototypes is the most successful or feasible, then you get into iteration, which is like, okay, we're going to do this base procedure, but we're going to tweak this and this and this about it and see what comes out.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, to me, I think like that's all a part of, I mean, like you can separate out a like prototyping phase from the iteration section, but that to me is all of the iteration. So like the prototyping and then like trying multiple iterations of the complete dish, that's like all a part of the iteration, which is sort of like the physical testing. And then we kind of like mentioned this before, but I think it's like, and I think this is common for a lot of chefs, this isn't necessarily how I work. I usually like to have a pretty solid idea of what I'm going to test, like the iterations that I'm going to try before I go and start testing it. And I don't know, maybe this is only like how chefs on TV do it. I'm not sure, but I think I've seen like, you know, other people that I work with test, do their brainstorming in a physical way, you know, so they have a bunch of ingredients and they just start cooking and messing around. And definitely like I've like come up with ideas in doing that too. Like I've come up with good ideas while just like pulling out my stuff to make dinner or something like that, you know, and totally you just like have your hands on food and you're like, oh, what if I juiced this fennel instead of, you know, turning it into a salad or something, you know, like you just come up with an idea and then you like try it and you're like, oh yeah, that was a great idea. So I think definitely like the brainstorming part can, you know, easily sort of like happen, more easily happen, I think, for some chefs when they're actually cooking. And so that might be what you have to do to brainstorm. Like if it's way easier for you to come up with ideas while you actually have your hands on the food rather than when you're walking through the forest or taking a shower or whatever, then that's great. Like more power to you. And then that is just a part of the conceptualization phase, I think, in that case. And then if you can sort of like roll that into the iteration phase, phase and sort of put off the feasibility, like cost considerations, equipment considerations and stuff until after you've tried a bunch of iterations. I think that that's totally valid too, provided that you have the time to do that.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where it gets a little tricky, because for me, I feel like the reason why I like to have a good idea of what I'm going to test before I go into the testing phase is because I feel like, yeah, I could really go down a rabbit hole of like testing a million things that would never be feasible.
Right.
And that's a lot of time, especially if you're doing it in a professional capacity. If you're just like messing around at home, that's one thing. But like, you know, if you're doing it to develop a menu for a restaurant, and especially if it's like an entire menu, your timeline is, you know, pretty tight. Mm-hmm. You don't have necessarily all the time in the world to fool around and get ideas, which I think often when you see chefs in the movies working on ideas, it seems like they have all of the time in the world or something like right. that. Maybe not or on the bear. On the,
you already mentioned in our conversation about the movie Chef, like how they're just kind of casually changing the entire menu the day of their first service. Like that's,
it's like my pet peeve of cooking yeah, movies. Yeah. It's like, what are we going to cook today?
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, they did drop off a whole pheasant. Can do something with that. Okay.
One piece that's really important for me, but again, not for everyone, not for every chef, but like, the importance of documentation as early as possible to start right. to start yeah. measuring. So when I start the iteration process, like let's say that when you're during the concept phase, you have an idea and you do your search, like you rack your brain, but then you say you do your Google search and see has someone done something similar. Well, surely someone has done something similar. Let's see what they've yeah. how they've done it. And you find something that you think works really well for your situation, and maybe you print a recipe off of the internet. And so yeah. I go into the iteration phase, like, this is our starting point. We're going to try this thing that this other person did. But then to say to whoever's involved in the project, like, we're going to mark this paper up like crazy. Like, we're going to, you know, they have volumetric measures. We're going to do it in grams. And they mm-hmm. were using this exact product, we're going to use this one, we're marking this up, and by the end we'll be able to produce our first standardized recipe that reflects what we did in our kitchen. And yeah, as soon as possible to be in terms of in a restaurant context, like in terms of repeatability and consistency, like to you have to be like a Galileo scientific method kind of stuff, where it's like,
yeah,
anything that's measurable, you measure it and you record it. And if it's not measurable, figure out a way to measure it. which again is not, I know that's not how all chefs operate, but especially in my context, when it's students doing most of the cooking, it's like really yeah. critical to give that kind of that specificity.
Well, and I think like for most chefs who take their creative, like this sort of like creative process seriously, it is pretty like, I don't think it's necessarily like every person in the process is always exposed to it at every step. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, it would be if you had an idea for a dish that you wanted executed in El Bulli, and you made the dish for Ferran Adrià, and he sat down and ate it and was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Yes, we need to put this on the menu. How did you make it? And you mm-hmm. have no measurements for how you made it.
Right. Yeah.
It would just be a non-starter. It'd be like, oh, well, actually, we don't know how to make it. We mm-hmm. just made it up as we went along, and I don't remember anything. So yeah, documentation is very important. And I usually, like in every kitchen that I've worked in, I usually have like some like pre-made documentation to give to people who want to test dishes that has like basically like blank recipes like yes. in a grid, and then they fill out the ingredients, and then there's room for volumetric measurements and weight measurements, and mm-hmm. you know, so that you can track all of those things as you go. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a yeah at first when you start to cook that way to test things, it feels cumbersome, but after a while it just sort of becomes second nature that as you're like measuring out your ingredients, you just like drop them on a scale. You just have a scale there with you, and you have a pen and your form beside you, and you just fill it out as you go. And then when you're done, you just have this, you know, beautiful documentation of every step that you took.
One interesting, like when I think of restaurants that operate on a very high level, like say like the Alinea cookbook, like that's what I think of. It's like, yeah, it's like it's 5 grams of this and 125 grams of this, and it's like a formula. Yeah. But one interesting contrast to that, and I don't know how much it appears in like really, really high level restaurants, but like at Naramata Inn this summer, partly because of like they were so into seasonality that even day to day they'd be working with different ingredients. And so it was difficult for them to have formula like that. And so there was like, for instance, like a, basically like a kind of whatever you want to call it, like a salsa verde on a scallop dish. Yeah. And what was actually in it changed every few days, and it relied on the, like the intuition and the skill of the garde-manger cook to just make a sauce that has this vibrant green color, this consistency, but some days it's based on fennel fronds and some days it's based on, you know, basil and spinach and stuff like that.
And so if you have an idea for like what that component is providing in the dish, like if that component is meant to provide herbaceousness, then, you know, you kind of have an idea of how you want it to taste, but you have to adjust the amount of specific ingredients that you're putting in it depending on what you have or whatever.
Yeah.
That's definitely, you know, like a different way of working. And I think, you know, requires a little bit more experience and intuition and skill and stuff like that. But I think like, you know, how you get to that point is by doing a lot, you know, like that comes from experience. Like, you know, knowing that you can, you know, trusting yourself that you can come up with something that's going to provide what you need for the dish sort of on the fly comes from doing a lot of systematic work and tasting a lot of things and understanding what's going to happen with the flavors when you go to make a dish. And like definitely having experience is going to cut down the number of iterations that you need to make something work correctly. But probably in those situations too, like the garde-manger is having somebody taste it and collecting opinions and collecting feedback from people and then potentially altering it based on other people, like on the chef's feedback or, you know, maybe some other cooks in the kitchen's feedback or something to get it right. Like, you know, if it's supposed to provide the acidity for the dish, then you want it to have a certain flavor profile. And so you have to like change the mix of ingredients that you're going to use in it based on that particular characteristic that you want to try and highlight in it or whatever. And I think too, like how a lot of that stuff sort of worked, how a lot of like testing and iteration worked at, like in a place like Noma is like things would like the brainstorming phase is sort of like this like projects that we would do every week. So like at the end of the week, every week, everyone would get together in the kitchen and taste a few like dish proposals from people. And also, we would receive like ingredients. You know, the ingredients that we were receiving would change from day to day and week to week, and we would have to sort of like alter what was in some of the dishes to use the more seasonal product that was coming in or whatever. But they had like just, and mostly I think this was like electronic, but like the sous chefs and stuff had access to it, but they just like, you know, had this like library of recipes that they used for every single component on every dish since like the opening of the restaurant. So and like there are so many components and so many dishes that like, you know, I think it was like in most circumstances, if you knew like what you wanted the component, like what characteristics you wanted the component to have on the dish, you could just like go through the list of previous components and pick like something that was similar and be like, oh yeah, we're going to make a gilet, but instead of making it with like, we made it with parsley last time, this time we're going to make it with chervil or something, you know, like there was always something that was like previously on the restaurant menu that was reliable that you knew that you could, you know, make use of to, you know, even if you were using a different ingredient or whatever. And so once you sort of have that catalog, whether it's in your own repertoire or in the restaurant's repertoire, you can sort of like rely on that to go back and do the iteration more quickly or more reliably or whatever.
That's something that most restaurants I've worked in are really terrible at. Possibly like, because a lot of chefs and cooks aren't, a lot of them aren't computer documentation typing kind of people. Some of them are,
right. But like, yeah, I mean, it could just be like a recipe book too, but you know, usually keeping your recipe book full of every recipe that the restaurant has ever produced, you have a pretty big recipe book. So, you know, maybe you have to put archived recipes on a shelf or something, but you can do it on paper too. It's just that, you know, it's much easier to just be able to like search for things, obviously.
Yes. But okay, are we on to analysis or like evaluation?
So then, so you've got iteration and you're doing some documentation during that process. Then you want to collect feedback from people. And so you take maybe your three or four or five iterations that you think are like good variations and you let everybody taste them and decide which one's best.
Do you let anyone taste it? Anyone on the street, or you have?
I mean, potentially. Yeah. I don't know. Like I could see a situation where, well, I know that on Kitchen Nightmares, they used to do that. Was it at Kitchen Nightmares, I think?
I don't know.
On Kitchen Nightmares, they used to like take food out on the street and serve it to people to decide what they should put on their menu.
Yeah, is there a way for
really weird?
At Kind, what if you did like you guys are always working on stuff and people could walk into a shop, like into one of the brick and mortar spaces and have like a flight of experimental ice creams. They pay an amount and then they get like, you know, a spoonful of five different ice creams and then they have to fill out a feedback card. Would you ever do something like that?
I mean, probably not because of feasibility issues.
Yeah.
You know, we have enough of a broad audience for tasting and gathering feedback and opinions amongst the staff. Like, if we really need more opinions than like the like kitchen crew and some of the front of house crew and the owners, you know, like if we need more feedback than that, there are like, you know, there's more front of house employees that we can call in. There's friends and family that we can call in. Doing it in the shop, I think, is probably like it's different than being in a sit down restaurant. It's mostly people coming in and grabbing ice cream and leaving the shop.
Right.
People aren't usually sitting. And
yeah. And it would take like a lot of time for your front of house staff to do something like that instead of just
exactly. Scoop, scoop, yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So I don't think that would like we're scooping ice cream fast in that place. So,
okay, fine.
So I don't think it would really fit into the service style. But I, you know, like, gathering feedback from customers, I think, is very common. Like if there are dishes that you potentially want to run on the menu and you want to iterate on them, oftentimes what restaurants will do is run them as features and then gather feedback from the customers. And if a feature goes over really well with customers, then it's something that you might want to consider putting on the menu. I think that's pretty common.
Like, for instance, a cola braised short rib with risotto, right? Something like that, where you just kind of put it on a customer's plate or on a customer's table and say, here you go, something we're working on, something like
that.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and then that might help to show your boss that they were wrong about your short rib all along.
Yeah, this is all an allusion to the bear, in case anyone didn't pick that up.
Oh man.
Anyways, okay, so you're getting feedback.
Yeah. So, and I do think that documentation is also very important in the tasting and analysis phase. Like, you need to have an idea of what you're looking for. You need to have an idea of what kind of feedback you want to gather, because everyone can offer an opinion, but oftentimes people forget to think about the things that you might that might actually be important to like the long-term success of a dish or something like that. And I think there are a lot of things that you kind of need to hit on, but I don't know, what's a short list? Like flavor, obviously, texture, obviously, those are very important. Aesthetically, how does it look? Also, like something that like we are often considering at Kind, and I think it's maybe on, more on a subconscious level. But like does the flavor and texture and aesthetic of the dish, does it accurately represent the concept in a way? You know, like if you are making strawberry ice cream and I don't know, you use like freeze-dried strawberries, say, and the ice cream is gray instead of pink. You know, is that what people are going to expect? Right. I don't know if that would happen. It probably wouldn't happen. It would probably make it extra pink. In fact, I should probably try that.
Write that down.
But like, yeah, write that down quickly, Alan. I'll never listen back to this. So, but like, yeah, does like the, do all of those things come together to represent what the original concept was, or like what, you know, like what you might like, let's say the original concept is like, the name of a dish, you know, like right. do the flavors and the textures and everything in the dish accurately rep, like let's say the concept is to make lemon meringue pie and you accidentally drop it on a plate or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Does it still represent lemon meringue pie, or is it something different? And should you then therefore not call it lemon meringue pie because it's going to be confusing for the customer or yes. something like that?
Yeah.
So yeah, like I think, you know, what would you even call that? It's sort of like the accuracy to the concept or something like that. And yeah. the flavor and the texture. And, you know, in the cases of ice cream, there's like very specific things that we're checking for too, like very specific textural things. So like mm-hmm. smoothness versus iciness, or, mm-hmm. you know, like coldness versus warmness, or like chewiness versus creaminess or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. like there are these very specific sort of textural and flavor things that happen in ice cream that we're sort of like checking for when we're going through the tasting phase. And we try to be like disciplined about making sure that when we're gathering feedback, we're asking people to provide their opinions about these very specific things, so that we can you know, we're not just getting a bunch of like, oh, I like it or I don't like it.
Yeah.
You know, like that's yes. not necessarily useful. What's more useful is like, why do you like it? Do you like it because of the texture? Do you not like it because of the texture? Like, mm-hmm. you know, can, and then therefore, is that something that we should potentially change? Like, you know, 5 people think that the texture is slimy or something, then, mm-hmm. you know, probably that's something that you want to change, unless you really want to make a dish that's slimy or something like that.
You should make an ice cream called Secret of the Ooze. It's a Ninja Turtle themed ice cream. And you can give it a slimy
texture. Oh, man,
texture.
That would be perfect for a 90s series yeah. ice cream.
There you go. That one's for free.
Okay, thanks. You're going to make me look like a genius, Alan.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Like trying to solicit the specific, useful, critical information instead of open-ended stuff that just, especially when the people who are giving you feedback don't necessarily know what the kernel of inspiration was, and maybe don't have an understanding of the constraints and feasibility side of it, but trying yeah. to yeah focus the feedback. That's something that it's actually quite difficult, especially with something like presentation for a composed plate yeah. where it's like, what do you think of this plating? And they're like, well, what if you did this? And then if you have 8 people in the room, like everyone's going to have a different idea. And it's just like, so you do need the, again, kind of relating to the through line of like the importance of the concept staying through all of the elements, and that requires, or sorry, all of the stages of the process. And so it yeah. requires like a kind of like, there's an, whatever you want to call it, the, in the case of like, you're the artist kind of who needs to guide the ship through so that the initial concept, what's wrong?
It's really funny that. It's really funny that you said ship, because I was kind of like, while you were saying that, I was sort of feeling, or I was kind of like thinking that like, yeah, your concept for your dish is sort of like a ship of Theseus. Like right. as you're moving through the process, like you're changing everything about it. And then when you get to the end, is it still the same dish? You right. know, like.
I'm really embarrassed to say that I just did the worst mixed metaphor ever. And I said, you are the artist who is guiding the ship. That was dumb. Sorry.
It's You're almost kind of more a Malifor. Like a
captain, maybe. Is that what, who guides yeah. the ship? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
But yeah, like, and I think that that's where, yeah, exactly. So like, does this, does the dish relate or accurately represent the original concept is an important piece of feedback to try and gather. Mm-hmm. And in order to try and gather that feedback, you have to inform people about what the concept is. Right. And sometimes the concept is really easy to grasp, like strawberry ice cream. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like sometimes, okay, so maybe you want to make strawberry ice cream, but you want to make it a little bit different. You want to, I don't know.
Put star anise in it.
Yeah, or
basil.
Like use like roasted strawberries or something mm-hmm. like that. And, you know, maybe by the time you get to tasting it, you know, you've changed out the components enough that maybe like it doesn't feel very strawberry anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say you wanted to use a fluid gel and you can't quite make it taste exactly like strawberry or something. And then by the time you get to the tasting part, people are like, well, you told me this is strawberry ice cream, but I'm not really tasting a lot of strawberry. I'm mostly tasting like buttermilk and roasted flavors. So then, you know, like then, you know, you have to go back and either change
the concept,
yeah, exactly. And so, and then once you get through tasting, I mean, I think it would be foolish to expect that when you go into the tasting, phase that all of the feedback that you're going to get is going to align with what you originally conceived. Right. And so, you know, I think that it's reasonable to expect that after you do tasting and gather a bunch of information about other people's opinions and reactions to the dish, that you're going to have to go back through and do a second run of iteration and a second run of tasting. Mm-hmm. It's very rare, I feel like, where, or I mean, maybe it's not rare in like in kitchens where the chef doesn't care what anyone else thinks about the dish or something, but in most of the kitchens that I've worked in where we want to try and make something that like makes sense to the owners and the servers and the customers and everyone. Generally, you're going to have people taste it, make suggestions, and then you're going to be like, oh, yeah, actually, that's like a really good suggestion. Or, yeah, mm-hmm. you're right. Like the dish doesn't really represent what we wanted it to. So we have to go back and take another crack at it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, but I think at that point, you can sort of you can narrow down the number of iterations that you want to do. You can be like, okay, well, this is the thing that we should change to make it more accurate. And then you can just retest that one thing or retest that one thing in two different ways or something.
One of the interesting kind of tensions in the analysis and feedback phase is that, like I mentioned that, or we've both mentioned, like how you want to focus the feedback on like specific critical elements. Right. But once in a blue moon, or even a little bit more frequently than that, someone offers something up that makes you completely reimagine the concept.
Yeah, totally.
And so the tension that I'm referring to is like, you want to be available when things like that happen, or you want like, because sometimes they're really game changing. Yeah. But if you open it up too much, then oftentimes you just get bogged down in petty,
in like 30 different potential ideas.
Yeah. So that's something that I struggle with, because sometimes there's like really fantastic ideas that come out of that. And you needed to go through concept and iteration and analysis to get those ideas. Like they don't just come out in the concept phase.
No, totally.
So it's hard. It's a hard balance, but.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's sort of somewhat important to have one voice or one or two voices that are sort of like the, you know, the guiding light for what the concept might be. So if it's, you know, in a lot of cases that might be the person who conceptualized the dish. So if it, you know, like potentially you can open up like the creative process, you know, to your entire staff if you want, and you can show people how to test things and show people how to walk through this process and how you do it in your specific restaurant or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like then it can become like a little bit like either that person can sort of take responsibility for deciding which things are, which feedback is important, or which feedback is like, going to have a positive effect on the dish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you kind of need one person or two people who are sort of like the guiding light for that particular idea or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. And it's usually the person that conceptualized it.
Right.
because they usually have an idea in their head of what they want. And then, you know, it's a matter of like getting close enough to that original idea and to something that's going to be feasible and is going to be exciting to the customer, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, yeah, that's the problem with moving through this process. And the fact that it's so complicated is that a lot of the time when you get to the end, yeah, you don't really feel like much connection to your original idea of what the dish could be, or right. and especially like in cases where someone else has an idea but then another person is sort of like doing the actual like physical testing of it, it's, you know, like you can kind of try to explain your idea to someone as best you can or try and translate it, but it's sometimes things get lost in translation, and then you get to the tasting part and the person whose idea it was is like, this is not really what I was imagining.
Right.
And then yeah. you just, you know, have to go back and start from scratch or something. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I feel like that type of thing can feel very overwhelming if you don't have some sort of like structure around how you do this work. If you don't know, once you get some feedback that like is causing you to have to reevaluate what the idea is or something, that can seem very daunting if like you haven't documented things properly, so you can't go back and recreate what you know what you tasted, or mm-hmm. if the feasibility and concept and iteration are all sort of like the same process and you're not really kind of thinking about them individually, then going back and changing one part of the idea can seem like you have to rethink that entire process. Whereas if you know that the concept is reasonable and that there is going to be a feasible way to get the ingredients and do the work or whatever, mm-hmm. Then maybe if you get some negative feedback about something, it's pretty easy to go back and be like, well, actually we should just try and retest this one prototype that we did or whatever.
Right. Yeah. So the last stage do you call it execution, or what do you call it?
Yeah, I call it execution, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's what I did call it. I don't know if that's the best name for it, but that's what it says mm-hmm. in my show notes document here. And so that to me is like, you have the idea, everyone's satisfied with it, but then you have to produce it. Mm-hmm. Either like you need to ramp up production, like in our case at the ice cream shop, it's like, okay, now we need to make enough of this to sell at the stores. So mm-hmm. what does that process look like? You know, I made 500 grams of like potato and put it into ice cream and churn a small batch of potato ice cream in the countertop ice cream maker. Mm-hmm. And I was able to order a small tin of caviar from like the fish supplier and get that in. But what does it look like if I have to make 30 liters of that a day? And mm-hmm. provide enough caviar to the shops that they can put caviar on top of everyone's potato ice cream. Mm-hmm. You know, like, how's that going to work? And like, we've gone through feasibility, so we have an idea of how that's going to work, but we actually have to then go ahead and do it. And sometimes when you go ahead and do something, you realize that there's a problem that you maybe hadn't anticipated.
Right.
Maybe in the case of the potato ice cream, if you're putting like some mashed potatoes, is like the kind of thing that could get a little bit gummy and chewy. And maybe churning potatoes in the ice cream in the countertop machine doesn't have that effect because it's kind of like a slow moving process. But in our large batch freezer, maybe the blades move too fast and they turn the mashed potatoes in the ice cream into like a gluey mess mm-hmm. and the texture is totally different. Okay, well, then there's obviously something that we have to do to try and fix the problem. And
it's almost like it's another type of iterative process where the first one, because of economic constraints, needs to be done on a small scale until yeah. you get the presentation, flavor, texture, the actual stuff that's going in people's mouths, right? But then you kind of need to do another iterative process once you're operating on full production scale, because
yeah.
just like, even though you try to address it all in the feasibility analysis, once you're operating on scale, there will always be something that comes up that you need to fix, right? Does that make sense? Like, do you agree?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And like, if you have been, you know, working with the people and the set of equipment and the set of skills that you normally work with a lot for a long time, and you really have a solid idea of like what is producible mm-hmm. in like the environment that you're working in. And there's a good chance that like, you know, a lot of the things that might come up that might be problems will automatically sort of get addressed in your original feasibility analysis, mm-hmm. you know? But I think in most cases, the execution phase, like the changes that happen and the reiteration that happens in the execution phase is just like little tweaks to streamline the process of making the dish and streamline getting the quality correct every time you produce it. Mm-hmm. You know, like little tweaks here and there, like just moving a couple of things around on the line so that it's like more organized, or, you know, like maybe the first time you have it, that you're serving a dish during service, you are keeping one of the sauces hot because you think that it'll be easier. But then after an hour, you realize that that's like negatively affecting the texture of the sauce. And mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. then, you know, you have to, after a couple of days, you have to change your line setup so that you can heat that sauce to order and do it in a way that's efficient. Those like little tweaks and little like efficiencies, you know, come over time of like, of working on the dish at scale or mm-hmm. whatever. And a lot of those things you can't necessarily solve until you understand, you know, what those problems are going to be. Mm-hmm.
I know every project is different, but how long do you think it typically takes to work through the process issues once you have a flavor and ice cream that you're happy with and want to invest on scale? How long does it take to work out the process? Is it like two runs or 10 runs? Or I know they're all different.
Yeah, they are all really different. Sometimes it takes no runs. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're just like, oh yeah, this is dead simple. yeah, exactly. This is really easy and everything worked out the way that we were expecting it to. I would say in most cases, if we go to produce like a flavor of ice cream at scale and wind up running into a problem, we usually fix it within like the... any major problems are usually worked out by the third time we make it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the first time we make it, like let's say when we made the small batch, it seemed like a specific, and this happens quite often, like in the small batch, we'll use a specific amount of like inclusion that we're going to put into an ice cream. Mm-hmm. And then when we batch it up, sometimes, you know, either because it's harder to distribute it evenly or something, it just, or just like when you're going to scoop it in like the regular scoop size, rather than just taking a couple of spoonfuls out of a container to taste it or whatever, mm-hmm. it's just like harder to get the even amount of inclusions that you want in a scoop. And so a lot of times we'll find like when we batch up that we wind up maybe having to add more inclusions.
Right. Yeah.
To make it seem like it was when we tasted it on the smaller scale. Mm-hmm. It's also like a difference in, because like oftentimes like our inclusions we're measuring in a volumetric way. Oh, yeah. Because it's just much easier in terms of being able to incorporate it into the ice cream. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're working with solid inclusions, but then measuring them volumetrically, like,
yeah.
So like, let's say pieces of cookie, like a half a cup of pieces of cookie should batch up to be, in most cases, in the way that we test, like a half a cup of cookie in a test recipe should batch up to be roughly 4 liters of cookie mm-hmm. in the batch. But then, you know, sometimes that 4 liters of cookie just doesn't seem like as much as the half a cup did in the small batch. And so you just have to like add more. But I think that in most cases, by the time we make it for the third time, we have it pretty nailed down to be as close to the original test as possible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some other issues that we'll run into is like some ice creams are richer than others. And so when we're churning them in the big machine, like you'll get a little bit of butter that forms around like parts of the moving parts in the machine. Sometimes Yeah. So you get like buttering in some flavors and you have to watch out for that. You have to like churn it for slightly less time or churn it on a lower speed to try and get less butter formation. Or sometimes you'll get like more air than you expected because the batch freezer churns a lot faster. Mm-hmm. And so you'll get a lot more overrun. And sometimes that will like really change the texture. And so you have to adjust the speed or something like that. But usually I would say by the third time we make it, we have it pretty much nailed down for how we're going to do it for the month. Mm-hmm. And then, or like forever more if it's like an always flavor.
Right.
But then there's also usually like the actual churning of the ice cream, I think, is like probably the thing that is the easiest to iterate and solve once we're in production.
Right.
It's usually things like batching up a cake recipe or a cookie recipe and doing that at scale and portioning it at scale that, you know, that we kind of run into efficiency problems. And so sometimes it'll take us like a week or so to figure out the right batch size of something, you know, to make where it'll still fit in our mixer and it'll still fit in our oven, but we get enough that it's enough for a couple batches or that usually takes a week maybe.
Yeah.
To figure that out, a week and a half, because also we'll often make big batches and then, you know, we'll be making enough so that we made enough to last us for like two or three rounds of churning the ice cream. And sometimes that's like a week's worth. And so it'll be like a week before we make the second batch of cookie, say, or something. And so the iterations of that are a little bit slower. Yeah. If we don't, you know, like if the product is usable, you know, like in cases where, you know, maybe we go to make something at scale and we wind up with something that's not usable, well, then we have to quickly iterate and figure out how to make something that's usable or whatever. But
and then once the kind of process engineering side of it is done, you have all the documentation and you print it out and put it in a little filing cabinet and you're like, we did it. This one is part of the official repertoire now, right?
That's right.
And that feels good.
Yeah, usually.
What?
If it's, you know, like...
What do you mean usually?
Well, you know, like you said, like sometimes if it's your idea and during the process of making it, you feel like it gets pretty disconnected from the original concept that you had or something like that, then, you know, sometimes it's not as exciting as other times. But yeah, I mean, it's always satisfying to, once you get something that everyone's happy with and you produce it at scale and you put those recipes into the recipe archive and you're like, okay, yes, we've figured out how to do this thing. Yeah, it's usually a satisfying feeling. And then you move on to the next one.
Then you move on to the next one, do it a couple hundred more times, and then you publish your cookbook.
That's right.
Right?
Alan, how did you know?
Do you think there'll ever kind ice cream cookbook?
I don't know. It's possible. It's definitely something that we've talked about and like not in a totally nebulous and not serious way, but I think like currently there's still just a lot of other stuff that is priority.
Yeah.
At Kind. And so it's kind of like probably a little bit of a down the road project. And also nobody that works at Kind, I think, has ever really published a book before. So we would need to find someone who could sort of like shepherd us through that process. And I don't exactly know who that would be, but if you've ever published a cookbook and you're listening to this podcast right now, definitely hit me up.
I think there's lots of people in Edmonton who could help with that.
Like definitely there's some great cookbooks that have come out of Edmonton.
Like the people who made Edmonton Cooks.
Yeah, that's Tina Faye's a really nice book.
Brown and
it's beautiful and there's good recipes in there.
Yeah.
The Duchess cookbook is also great.
Yeah. It's gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. That's okay. So like we've talked about this a lot. There's like really beautiful cookbooks that aren't so practical and practical cookbooks that maybe aren't beautiful. But like the Duchess cookbook is so gorgeous and the technique, like it's not just a recipe book, like the techniques, like they describe like the classic, like for Pat Sucre, like the classic fraisage mixing and en français, like molding into the tart. It's like such a good book. It's so good. Like has the level of detail that like advanced bread and pastry has, but it doesn't seem like an institutional textbook kind of. It's
totally
a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels it feels like in the same sort of like category as something like the French Laundry
yes.
cookbook,
yeah,
where
totally,
like they
yes.
walk you through every, you know, every important piece of information that you might need to like properly execute something. And there are some things that you really just can't communicate in a book, but for the most part, like they do a really great job of like trying to communicate all the little details that you might need to consider to be able to reproduce something that you got in their shop at yeah. your house.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. A lot of work, I'm sure, to produce that book.
Yeah.
Well,
see you later.
Is that it? Did we make an episode? I feel like we didn't end on a joke, but that's probably okay.
Not everything needs to be a joke show.
Oh, that's so not correct, Alan.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.